Welcome to the Raising Your Game podcast, where I bring to you the stories, insights, and ideas from those in the world of sport to help you build a stronger mind, more resilient body, and healthier life. Whether you're an up-and-coming athlete in the making or a seasoned professional, this show promises to give you something that you can use for positive change and help you in raising your game. Hey guys, welcome back to the podcast. I'm Lewis Hatchett, and in this episode, I'm excited to bring you Dan Van Zandt. Dan is a flexibility researcher, educator, and coach, and he's probably one of, if not the most knowledgeable people in the world of flexibility. This episode is one that brings a lot of knowledge and science. I kind of geek out a little bit in this one because I was really excited to speak to Dan on so many different subjects, and we mainly dive into the importance of flexibility for athletes, how best to build it, where to start. We talk about some of the myths that are around flexibility, its impact on the body, also a really interesting part that's around the impact on the mind for athletes. So we also spend a little bit of time talking about how yoga allows that to be a form of training that can blend both the body and the mind. So if you are someone who is like me when I first started out, like the Tin Man, and feel really stiff, really tight, and know that flexibility is something that you should be doing and really taking care of as a part of not only just your sporting goals, but just everyday living, then this episode is going to be for you. Dan brings so much knowledge, so much science, so much research that is a part of what he does, as well as coaching coaches. And he is, like I said, the most knowledgeable person I've met and heard of on this subject. So really excited to bring you this episode, and it's going to be a real good one. If you're a new listener to the show, perhaps a long-time listener, could you do me one thing? And that is hit that subscribe button on whatever platform you're listening on. It's the only way you can ensure you don't miss out on new episodes, and it's the easiest way to support the show and what I'm trying to do, especially if you are enjoying these episodes. That's the one ask I'm going to have before we get going, and I bring you the awesome Dan Van Zandt. Enjoy. Dan, thank you so much for coming on. I've actually been super excited for this conversation. We've just had a little bit of back and forth already about the importance of this conversation for people in sport. But I know you're a well sought after man. And have you been over the last few weeks? How's things going?
Yeah, pretty good. There's been a lot. My inbox has been overwhelmed the last kind of few weeks because I don't know what it is, but the last few weeks, last couple of months, in fact, there's been a lot of nonsense being pushed out about flexibility and stretching by people who are extremely well-educated in their domain. But I don't know what it is about stretching and flexibility. People who are experts in, say, nutrition or physical therapy, they look at flexibility and stretching and think, well, you know, I'm an expert in this, therefore I'll be an expert in that. And they put out posts about studies that they obviously don't even read. So I've been pushing back against this nonsense. But the last few weeks to couple of months have just been absolutely manic, you know, the amount of nonsense that's being pushed out. So as an educator, I feel like I have a responsibility to share with people what the science actually says, not what somebody's flawed interpretation of that science is. And so it's actually helped me out a lot because it's garnered a lot of attention for my platform, which is great.
Yeah.
But it's really busy. Really, really busy.
So before, yeah. I think we'll circle back to all of that, what you've mentioned, because I think it's a really interesting point and something that you're brilliant at highlighting. But let's just, for the listeners to start off with, let's just dive into your background, what sparked your interest in flexibility, and even your background in sport. I know you've got some background in martial arts, and that's where you've come from. But yeah, tell the listeners whereabouts you've sort of come from.
Yeah, so I started training in martial arts around the age of 4 or 5, primarily in striking, what we would call striking arts, which had a heavy emphasis on kicking. So things like taekwondo, karate, kickboxing, etc. And stretching is an absolute must in those disciplines. So I've actually been learning to stretch and been doing flexibility training for well over 35 years now, showing my age there. But I was very fortunate to have instructors who were very science-based. You know, most were university educated with either a bachelor's or a master's degree in subjects like sports science, physical education, exercise physiology. But they also had, you know, sometimes decades of practical experience. So I had, the ideal environment to kind of for this interest in flexibility training to blossom and develop. And I've always loved doing the high kicks and kicking people on the head. So I've always kind of needed to have an understanding of stretching and flexibility. But my first real interest in the science of the subject started in the early 1990s, because I attended a seminar with Thomas Kurz, who authored Stretching Scientifically. And if you've, you know, seen any of my content, you'll know I give him a lot of credit. And if you've read Stretching Scientifically, you will recognize his influence in my work. But I was fortunate enough to learn from Tom from like many, many, many seminars right through the 90s into the mid-2000s. And then, you know, he was like a mentor to me. So he had a huge influence on me. And my very first paid job as a teenager was actually teaching flexibility classes at the karate studio where I trained. You know, most kids have a paper round. Mine was teaching people how to do the splits and kick other people in the head. But even at that point, I was educating people about the science of flexibility. So, you know, in a professional capacity, I've actually been doing this for over 23 years now. And this was around 1997, 1998, you know, right when the internet was taking off. And right off the bat, I was also teaching people online about stretching and flexibility training. You know, we didn't have Facebook and Instagram and, you know, WhatsApp in those days. We had chat rooms, we had message boards, discussion forums. So I was using those and talking to people from all around the world. So I've been teaching this stuff online for as long as I've been doing it in a professional capacity. You know, my very first website, I don't know if you remember the old Angel Fire and GeoCities platforms, but it was like neon pink text with all these flashing GIFs and everything. It was hideous to look at, but, you know, people would log on and they would go in the chat rooms, exchange emails, things like that. And that is kind of continued for nearly a quarter of a century later. I went on to university and got bachelor's and master's degrees in kinesiology, which I went to the States for that. We don't have kinesiology in the UK. We would tend to call it sports science, but I specialized in sport and exercise biomechanics. And biomechanics has always been kind of the lens through which I've looked at flexibility, because biomechanics and flexibility are integral to each other. When we consider what flexibility is and how we measure range of motion, it's actually a branch of biomechanics called osteokinematics, but I'll not get into that now. And you know, I've taught at many universities across Europe, University of Zurich, University College London, University of Manchester, you know, teaching people about what the science actually says. I've been a peer reviewer for several health and medicine journals. And yeah, you mentioned sporting background. You know, I don't just have the kind of academic background. I have the practical experience too. And I was a competitive taekwondo and karate athlete. I was the coach/player with the England full contact karate team, won a couple of world titles. But my passion has always been for coaching, but more so in the last 5 to 10 years, more about education. And I think there's a distinction between a coach and an educator, because, you know, I get a lot of people sending me a message saying, do you offer coaching? And I don't actually do coaching all that much anymore. My passion now is to coach the coaches, because one thing I've noticed throughout all the time I've been doing this is formal education on this subject is severely lacking. You know, it really is. It's funny because we can do full master's degrees in strength and conditioning. But when we, and I'll get into it a bit later on about how flexibility is fundamental, but when we look at all of the motor abilities, flexibility actually takes primacy, because you can have flexibility without strength, but you can't have strength without flexibility. And it sounds a bit counterintuitive, but it'll make sense when I talk about it later. But you know, we don't have any real education designed around this fundamental ability that's necessary for people, whether they're in sport or just trying to live their lives, you know. So that's my life in a nutshell.
Yeah.
I spend my days with my head buried in books and just talking people's ears off about stretching. So yeah, I found my life's passion really, really early on. So I've been very fortunate.
Yeah, no, and it shines through your work. Like everything you do is definitely, there's a integral part of it that shows that it's been a thought out process. It's not been, I see something, I'll post it. It's a deep dive into the subject, which is exactly why this was a conversation I was really keen on, because, and I think you actually had mentioned before you had become a yoga teacher as well. So you trained as a yoga teacher at the same time?
Yeah, long time ago. So this was kind of, as I was coming out of my teens and into my early 20s, like, you know, you start looking for how you can verify to people that you have this experience, because people, you know, they want to see the credentials. You know, you could tell somebody, I've been doing this 15, 20 years, and they're like, well, what qualifications do you have? Which is a bit of a misguided point of view, because it easily allows appeal to authority fallacies to take place, where people think that person's an expert, therefore their opinion is entirely valid. So I basically looked for any single course I could do to justify my position as a flexibility coach. I, you know, trained as a yoga teacher, trained as a personal trainer, went on to become a strength and conditioning coach. But you know, even in something like yoga, which we tend to think about as a flexibility practice, it's severely lacking in the science of flexibility. Now that's not to say yoga is an ineffective practice. I think yoga is a phenomenal practice. And it's not, I think to call it a flexibility practice undermines the benefits of yoga and really belittles what yoga is capable of producing, both for mind and body, and some would people say spirit as well. But like yoga as well is coming for a very difficult time on social media. Like when people are trying to promote their methods, they tend to use it as a bat to beat yoga around the head with. They're like, we're superior to yoga because yoga is just sitting and holding a stretch. It's not. If any, you know, anybody who's actually done a yoga class knows it's not just sitting and holding a stretch. And it depends entirely on the type of yoga you do. I trained as a yoga teacher. You know, I don't call myself a yoga teacher because I've not taught for many, many, many years, and I couldn't tell you half of the vocabulary for the postures or the asanas. You know, I just say, oh, that you know, head to the toe one.
Yeah.
But I became a yoga teacher because I needed something to verify that I was qualified to teach. To teach flexibility, because in the martial arts it's easy because you have a black belt, and so people see that as a sign that you're a, you know, qualified instructor, and whatever you say is true and effective, which unfortunately means there's a lot of nonsense in martial arts as well. So I trained as a yoga teacher, specializing in Hatha yoga, which is a very relaxed practice. You know, I don't know, certainly not Bikram yoga or anything like that. But that was many, many moons ago. But that has informed, you know, I took parts of that and used it to inform what I do today. And I think there are some incredible yoga practices out there. Yin yoga, for example, has actually more evidence to support it than the yoga practices which promote shorter postures. So yin yoga, for people who are watching or listening, not familiar, it promotes long duration you know, holds, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes at a time. And the research is very clear. The longer you hold a static passive stretch for, the greater the effect on a morphological and architectural level in the tissues. So yin yoga is actually ahead of the game in terms of tissue mechanics, because there's this kind of myth that's, you know, stretching is all neural, which is absolutely nonsense. If you hold it for 30 seconds or not even 30 seconds, as some yoga practices dictate, you're going to get mostly a neural effect. But some people need more than that. And that's where yin yoga kind of takes the lead. So, I don't call myself a yoga teacher, but I did qualify as a yoga teacher many, many moons ago.
But you're right. Like that, I mean, my background was that I started doing it in my professional career, and then I trained as a teacher. And a part of me even resonates with what you were saying there, was to justify your position in it. And it does. It is, having gone through any sort of flexibility training myself, the thing around yoga is that it does encompass the mind, and it does encompass, it does take it away from being just a purely physical practice. But at the same time, you're totally right. The scientific side of it is lacking, but that, I guess, is probably from its history. It's purely from its history and where it's come from. And it's not come from technically a scientific background, and it's grown into a more scientific background. So being able to blend those would be a beautiful place to be. And that will just help everyone. Do you think, and I think this was really interesting as you were talking about it, you talk about how you have the practical background in it. And do you feel that it's important, especially as a educator, to have that background, to almost be at ground zero with the people you're with, rather than almost standing there and saying, well, I've got these credentials? Do you kind of look back now, having been in the past, and thought, I'm going to seek out all these credentials? Do you have a different view on it now? Do you believe the experience and the experience of it yourself is the more valuable part?
I think so, absolutely. I think having some credentials is valuable just for legal reasons. You know, you need insurance, and oftentimes you need a valid qualification to get that. But it also puts people's minds at ease. You'll always get critical clients, students, whatever you want to call them, who will want to see some evidence of your ability or your knowledge. And having at least a credential, you know, supports that. But yeah, absolutely. I think you need, whatever you coach, you need some practical experience. Now, a lot of people, when it comes to flexibility training, they think you have to be able to do the splits and do a back bend in which you're practically dislocating your spine in order to be a good coach. Not true at all. You know, we look at some of the best boxing coaches in the world. You know, Cus D'Amato wasn't a world champion, but he still had experience. He had good technique, and he could translate concepts to the student so that they understood it and could implement it themselves. So yeah, I think people will just respect you more if you have the practical experience. You could say it's borderline fraudulent to say I'm a coach in this, but I have no experience, right?
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's like learning to drive off your 6-year-old, you know, nephew or something, you know, somebody who has no experience. It's like, no, we need, you know, and especially in this day and age, you know, where online training is prevalent, it's you know, really come to the front thanks to the pandemic. But on the internet, people can pose as whoever they want to be. So I think if you're being a coach in any kind of realm, if you can demonstrate things, it just makes things a lot easier, and people have greater buy-in with you, and it establishes trust and rapport with the people you are trying to coach. But I don't think it means you have to have, you know, elite levels of flexibility at all. A fact about me that some people don't know is many moons ago I had a very brief stint in the army after 9/11 and got injured. So that was a very, very short career change.
Wow.
But because of the injuries, they caught up with me over the years, and I eventually needed both hips replacing.
Wow.
So after the surgery, I got my splits back. But because there was complications, I developed a chronic pain condition, which actually has robbed me of the ability to do splits right now. Wow. So in my current condition, I can't do the splits. I'm gaining it back. I've gotten back into training now that my condition is under control. The thing about flexibility is it's like anything, it's like strength, it fluctuates. Mm. And sometimes things will happen in life where they come along and they rob you of your capacities. Now, if my whole coaching identity was embedded in my ability to do the splits, I wouldn't be able to teach anything. And I think sometimes not being able to have mutant levels of flexibility, you're still a work in progress yourself, and you can document that change over time, adds authenticity to your coaching practice. And people, especially older adults who are struggling themselves, will align with that more, because many of the flexibility coaching programs you see out there are by people who have abnormally large ranges of motion because of the structure of their joints, or they have some connective tissue thing going on. You know, we'd call them hypermobile. Mm. And they take advantage of that and they say, do my program, you know, because these are the stretches I did to get flexible. It's like, well, no, you've been training in dance since you were 2 years old.
Yeah.
That's why you're flexible. And these stretches are simply things you do to maintain or display your flexibility. But, you know, your 30-second leg behind the head pose isn't going to work for a guy who's in his 50s and just wants to improve a bit of hamstring flexibility.
Yeah, that's a really good point and an amazing. I didn't know that about you, and you've clearly just shared that, the story of you going to the army and having both hips replaced. But I resonate with the injury side of it, and that for me. So for me, my left hip takes a huge amount of force through the sport cricket, and that it literally hinders your progression of trying to build that flexibility. However, if I hadn't been doing flexibility training, yoga, or anything to mitigate the damage that was being done, God knows where I'd be right now. My girlfriend literally asked me that last night. She was like, "What would happen if you hadn't done, you didn't stretch?" I was like, "I would honestly hate to think where I'd be right now." And that it really does fluctuate. But the impact of injuries, I've had surgeries on knees, and I think that's such an important point, that you don't have to be this super bendy, flexible. That's you don't know the history of that person, like you said, and wherever you're, and that's it should only be looking at where your progress was, where you came from, let's say from a few weeks ago to where you are now. And then that's something to measure yourself on, rather than this whole process of, I'm looking at someone on Instagram who's got 2,000 likes on a backbend that I'm never going to achieve. At the same time, what practicability has that got for me as an athlete? So let's dive into flexibility itself. What for you, what is the definition of flexibility?
Yeah, this is an interesting one, because a lot of the antagonism that takes place on social media is about, you know, what is flexibility?
Yeah.
And one of the most prominent myths that you'll see on social media is that people are defining flexibility as just a passive quality. They're saying it refers to a person's passive range of motion. But it's a myth because, you know, not just how that word is defined literally, but also that's not how it's defined in the scientific literature. Ironically, this definition of, you know, flexibility being just this passive quality didn't arise because we've always said flexibility is passive range of motion, because we haven't. It arose because, you know, some people who became influential because of certain books they wrote or certain training programs that they delivered, they use the word mobility to describe what they call active range of motion, which they define as the ability to, you know, move your joints under your own control. But the problem was, people would come to them and say, well, what about flexibility? So they're thinking, well, we've got mobility as active range of motion, because they're using a limited model of range of motion, because there's not just active and passive range of motion, there's also static and dynamic. They said, well, mobility is active, therefore flexibility is passive. Now, you know, the problem with that is that definition of mobility is very fluid. It's not stable. It changes from one person to the other. There's no universal definition. For some people, it's flexibility plus strength. Some people say it's flexibility plus strength and control. The problem with that is, you know, what about the other motor abilities? What about endurance? What about agility? What about speed? These are the fundamental attributes of motor fitness that are, you know, abundant throughout the scientific literature, right? Mm. And we have six of them: strength, flexibility, strength, endurance, speed, agility, and coordination. Mm-hmm. So if that's somebody's definition of mobility training and you want to be fast or have endurance, then don't do mobility training because they don't account for speed or endurance.
Yeah.
But you know, if people want to use the word mobility in that way within the context of their, you know, of coaching with their clients, and that's their right. Now, I respect the right to free speech and people can use whatever words they want to use. The problem is when they start telling the rest of the world that these definitions are accurate, and even go so far as to insist that they're scientifically accurate. But when you look at the scientific literature, and if you want to claim to be science-based, which many of these people do, you have to take your lead from the scientific literature, because that's where we find terminology which is far simpler, far more accurate, and far more consistent. And whenever you look, I did a literature review about 5 or 6 years ago with a colleague of mine from California, and we looked at more than 17,000 studies which talked about flexibility. And in more than 95% of them, and it was a very, very long, tedious literature review, but 95% of them defined flexibility as range of motion, period. And we even looked at the word mobility, and in the scientific literature, mobility is barely even used in reference to range of motion. You'll get some studies which will use that term. But most studies which talk about mobility are referring to the ability to maintain a mobile base of support, i.e. walking, you know, going from your lounge to the kitchen and back again, or walking up and downstairs. And this is why things like wheelchairs, Zimmer frames, electric scooters are called mobility aids.
Yeah, right.
But when you look at that scientific definition of flexibility, range of motion, it aligns up with the dictionary definition of flexibility. And there's typically two parts: the ability to bend easily without breaking, but also the ability to change, to adapt to different circumstances. And that second part is very important because it aligns perfectly with what range of motion actually means. People just think range of motion means how much something moves, but it comes from physics and it has a very specific definition. So the word motion has been used in a branch of physics called classical mechanics, and that's where we get biomechanics from.
Mm-hmm.
And the word that word motion has been used for hundreds of years, and it means to change position. That's what motion actually means. You know, something changes position. Range means, you know, an amount of something. So range of motion means the amount that something has changed position. In terms of joint flexibility, the thing which changes position is a joint.
Yeah.
So flexibility and range of motion are used so interchangeably, they're basically the same thing. Flexibility is your ability to change the positions of your joints, i.e. it's the ability to move your body.
Mm.
And this has profound implications for the relationship between flexibility and the other five motor abilities, because you can only display strength or endurance or speed where you can move your joints, i.e. they all occur within the limits of your flexibility. So this is why you cannot have strength without flexibility, but you can have flexibility without strength. It's simply static passive flexibility, and it can be developed without developing any of the other motor abilities. But whenever you move your body to develop endurance or speed or strength, etc., one of three things will happen. You'll either maintain your flexibility, increase it, or decrease it. So it's having a training effect on flexibility. Therefore, everything you do is flexibility training.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't like hearing that. And the reason they don't like it is because they built their business model and their brand identity around this term mobility. And, you know, they get challenged on what mobility means and what about flexibility, and they try to play down flexibility. They'd have no trouble saying, you know what, flexibility and mobility, we're referring to a particular type of flexibility,
yeah,
but we prefer to use the term mobility because it sounds nice, right? Yeah. It's, you know, there's several brands out there that have this kind of alliteration thing going on, you know, mobility, the next word begins with an M, or the word before it begins with an M. I won't name any brands for legal reasons,
yeah.
But you know, they built their brand identity around this term mobility, and so they've had to mutate the long-standing, accurate definition of flexibility, but they're still claiming to be science-based. And all I say to them is, you know, they'll say, flexibility is just passive range of motion. I'll be like, Well, what about dynamic flexibility?
Yeah.
You know, there's thousands of studies on dynamic flexibility, and it's been around in the scientific literature since 1941. So yeah. We're just going to bypass 80 years of literature just so you can support your model. But again, that active and passive model of range of motion is inaccurate. Mm. There's not just active and passive. All active and passive tell us is the muscles are contracting or relaxing. That's it. They tell us nothing about whether the joint is moving or not moving. For that, we use static and dynamic. And, you know, if we go to basic physiology, the stretch reflex, there's two parts to it. There's a static stretch reflex and dynamic stretch reflex. That's literally the terms used in the scientific literature for many, many years. Yeah. So what are we going to do? Just bypass, you know, all the years of scientific research into dynamic and static stretch reflexes and just say, oh, we're just active and passive.
Yeah.
You know, and that has implications for training, because if you're not accounting for the state of motion, you can't account for velocity. So how can you do velocity-based training if you're just doing, you know, active and passive? If we're not accounting for motion, we're just doing isometric stretching or isometric training,
yeah,
right? Because there's no motion. So there's actually, so flexibility is range of motion or your ability to move your joints. And there are four types of flexibility, which just comes down to answering one or two questions. Is the joint moving or not moving? Are the muscles contracting or not contracting? If it's moving, it's dynamic. If it's not moving, it's static. If the muscles are contracting, it's active. If the muscles not contracting, it's passive. That gives us four types: dynamic active, dynamic passive, static active, static passive. That's it. That's as complicated as it gets.
And, you know? And just leading on to that, because what I'm hearing from you as well is that literally flexibility underpins everything there from mm-hmm. those components of fitness. So that is, it makes total sense when anyone is potentially, let's take it back to yoga, right? Let's take it back to a yoga asana, and you're trying to get into a pose. There are poses that require strength and for you to be active and to be static in them. But if your range of motion and your flexibility is not there to get into it, you feel weak as hell. Like you cannot physically produce that strength to stay there. So that's where, even from my own personal experience and my personal training now, I've shifted towards really focusing on opening up my range of motion, get my flexibility there, and then worry about strength when I get there, because I've built that strength up through certain methods of training, which have ultimately got to me to the point where I'm at right now. But there's almost another door that can be unlocked, and I can feel it slowly coming ajar, and it's starting to work through. Let's talk about those four types of flexibility. Is there one that you start with? Is there one that you feel is technically easier than the others, or one that perhaps shows more benefit than the others?
Yeah, and that would be static passive. And if you're a Lord of the Rings fan, you'll love this reference, but static passive flexibility is basically the one ring to rule them all. Because your static passive flexibility is the closest you can physically get to your anatomical limit of motion.
Right.
So the anatomical limit of motion is the absolute furthest you could move a joint without surgery, without dislocating the joint. And very few people will ever get their static passive flexibility to their anatomical limit of motion, but it's the closest we can get. So every other type of flexibility occurs within the limit of static passive flexibility. And that's because there are certain mechanical and neurological restraints which act on the body to stop the other types of flexibility ever being the same as static passive flexibility. Mm. So if you can do a 180 degree side split, as a static passive stretch, if you were to replicate that as a dynamic movement, you would probably get to about 165 degrees, you know, with long-term training and just focus on that, you could probably push it to 170. Most people who you can see in martial arts, we call it 180 degree side kick, where they kick straight up in the air, which is a dynamic analog of a split. They can typically do an oversplit. So their static flexibility goes beyond 180 degrees. And that's usually because they have abnormal joint structure or connective tissue which facilitates that, so the restraints which would normally act on the system aren't. Again, we refer to those as being hypermobile. But it's funny because you see lots of people posting on social media saying, if you want to improve the depth of your squat, just squat, bearing in mind that squat is a dynamic active motion. Your dynamic active motion will never match your static passive flexibility. So if your ability to get into a squat and hold that position under static conditions is 90 degrees or a parallel squat, you've no hope of increasing your dynamic squat with a dynamic movement. You can improve it a bit, but you still have to work on your static passive flexibility. Because again, all the restraints acting on the system, you've got stretch reflex, you've got tissue stiffness, all of these things, which the faster you move, especially the more they act against you. So if somebody's just trying to improve their dynamic flexibility without working on their static passive flexibility, they're just working against themselves. It's like running up against a brick wall. You know, what you have to do is knock down the brick wall, go a bit further forward and build that brick wall back up. And that's what static passive stretching does. And it's a great place to start for everyone because it's simple. It's you literally get into the position you need to improve and just hold it. You know, you move to the point of tension and just hold it. That's it. There's no contractions. There's no need to worry about movement. It's just you just sit there and hold it or stand there and hold it. That's it. It's very low intensity, although the further you stretch into it, the more intensity comes. And it's just a good place to start for everyone.
Yeah.
So anybody who's watching or listening to this and is thinking, oh, I want to start flexibility training, where do I start? Think about the things you want to do and then replicate those positions or those movements as a static stretch and just hold it, you know, just move to the point of tension, hold it. You'll feel after a little while, the tension will ease up, then just move into it a bit further and just progressively over time, that's how you increase your static passive flexibility. So yeah, if there's one that is of fundamental importance, it would be static passive. And it's funny because a lot of the mobility mafia tend to say, our static passive flexibility is useless. You know, what good is it? It's like, well, if you want to do, you know, certain movements, you need to be able to have the static passive flexibility first, or you're just going to be causing tissue strains and, you know, cramp. You know?
Yeah.
So it's that would be my answer anyway.
Yeah. How much of that physical makeup that you spoke about of someone's anatomical structure, how much does that play a part commonly? So because I think there's a lot of people that have this misconception that will say, like, I can't do the side splits, I'm not flexible enough, my body will never get into that position. And I always think, like, well, you never really know until you try, and you've never really known until you try to get there, because there must be an element where that does become a limiting factor, and sad to say, like in some sports, that is what can hinder people, is your physical makeup can be a limiting factor in, I don't know, if you're a swimmer and you're 5'8", you're not going to beat a 6'5" swimmer. Like, that's sometimes the thing that limits you. But with stretching and flexibility, how much of that commonly do you find is a limiting factor compared to the actual tissues not being able to get there?
Yeah, not very much, to be honest.
Yeah.
The biggest issue people have is neural tension. So they are weak and they lack experience in that position. So the nervous system's alarm response is dialed all the way up. So you have to use techniques which work with the nervous system to facilitate the increase in range of motion. Just speaking about the side split, the only real condition which can limit the side split is something called Coxavara. And that's just to do with how the head and neck of the femur are aligned with the pelvis, and trying to abduct the thighs would cause the greater trochanter to jam into the pelvis. Typically that's diagnosed in childhood. So if somebody is an adult and they haven't been diagnosed with Coxavara, then they're probably going to be fine. There is a simple test they can do, and it's in Tom Kurz's book, Stretching Scientifically, but all you have to do is prop your leg upon a table at about hip height with your toes pointing up. And if you can do that on each side, you performed a half side split on each side of the leg, on each side of the body, because no muscle runs from one leg to the other.
Yep.
So structurally you can more or less, it's not a, you know, gold standard validated test, but it's a quick and dirty way of figuring out if you have the potential to do it. Right. And so really the only thing that's stopping you from abducting both legs at the same time is nervous tension. So the nervous system is dialed all the way up, lack of strength, and also just a lack of experience of how to manipulate the pelvis in relation to the thighs. Because if you try and slide into a side split and keep your pelvis in a neutral position, you will get bone and bone contact. So you can do one of two things. You can interiorly rotate the pelvis, aka twerk, or you can externally rotate the hips, so the toes are pointing up towards the ceiling. And that will get you into a split. But the main thing that is stopping most people from doing a split is the nervous system, because they lack experience and strength in those positions. And the nervous system's job is to protect you from harm. So you have to earn that position. And I did a post a while back in which I said the nervous system is like an overprotective parent. You know, if you try, you know, its limit on your range of motion is like curfew. And if you try and break curfew, it will keep grounding you. So you have to show it respect and prove to it that you have earned the right to go beyond that curfew by getting stronger in the position, spending time in the position. That's how we work with the nervous system.
So how much of, I kind of wanted to touch on the when to be static and when to do dynamic, but at the same time, when is it a time to, you mentioned being going into static passive to start with, and that being the one ring, the rule, the more, and starting there. When do you start to shift into putting a bit more, whether it's static active, or when do you start to really build that resilience within the body in that position? Is it worthwhile spending a bit of time going static passive for a long time and getting that range, or incrementally building up actively?
Yeah, I mean, I try and get people doing, I mean, practically speaking, we really only develop dynamic active, static active, and static passive. We don't use dynamic active unless we're in physical therapy. It's a certain technique that people use, that therapists use to help deal with joint pain. So we don't really have to worry about that one. But you can start doing all three right off the bat. If somebody has never stretched in their life, or it's been years since they've attempted a stretch, and they haven't been working out regularly, I expect they'd have very, very low tissue tolerance. And by that, I mean that the tissue's ability to absorb force before it starts to get sore and break. So I would start people off with a couple of sets of 30-second stretches at the point of tension, and make sure that that doesn't cause delayed onset muscle soreness. Because for someone who has never stretched before, even doing a simple static passive stretch with moderate intensity can cause DOMS. And DOMS is a sign of muscle damage. So if a simple passive stretch is causing muscle damage, then doing something like isometrics or an eccentric stretch is probably going to cause greater damage. So I'd spend a week or two conditioning them with static passive stretches and learning the technique, and then start doing the dynamic active stuff, the static active stuff. But once the static passive stretches aren't causing soreness, they can start isometrically contracting those muscles in the stretch. And they'll probably find that when they combine it with static passive stretching, their flexibility really starts to take off. Because there's kind of false dichotomy in the health and fitness industry that we should either do strength or stretching, where most people are going to benefit from a combination of everything. I certainly wouldn't try to make the range of motion in the dynamic active stretches exceed the static passive stretches, because that at that point, you're typically having to use momentum and throw yourself forward, which is what we call ballistic stretching. It's a type of dynamic active stretching, but it's very, statistically speaking, from the literature, it's a very, very poor method for increasing range of motion. If anything, it makes range of motion decrease, because it elevates the response of the stretch reflex, and it's, you know, a recipe for tissue strains. So don't try to force your dynamic stretches beyond your static stretches. So as long as they're moving within, if they can tell what the limits of their static passive flexibility are, and they're moving within those limits, following up your static passive stretches with some just gentle movement within that range is a really good way to ingrain that movement pattern and to help the nervous system kind of get used to that position and to dial down its alarm response.
That's been a really effective way that I've found with young athletes that I've worked with. One in particular I'm working with right now, he is ultimately the tin man. Like he really is. He's very, very immobile at the moment. And one of the things is purely going to find his end ranges through static passive stretching, but also for him to understand where they're at, and for him to feel it, and then know those are his limits, and that he doesn't need to, like you said, throw himself into something that he cannot get into right now. And you mentioned about DOMS, and that being a massive factor for people that I've heard it so many times, and I'm sure you have as well, that people literally throw away any sort of stretching or flexibility training because they're like, well, I'm sore the next day. This doesn't work. And you're like, well, you haven't fully understood what's gone on there. Mm. So that's really a big point I think people should hear, is that if you are getting sore day after, it's not necessarily because it's not working. It's just where your body's at.
Yeah, you're just deconditioned, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's,
if you've been told by a doctor you need to start doing some running, right? So you get off the couch, you throw your running shoes on, you go and do a 5K run, and you know the last run you did was probably running away from your mum when you were stealing cookies from the cookie jar, when, you know, 20 years ago. You're probably going to have DOMS, but you know that once it subsides and you go back out again and you do it within a load that's manageable for your body's current condition, you're not going to have DOMS or not have it as much, right?
Yeah.
People are very averse to stretching, because it's difficult. It's not easy, And it's not just a physical practice. It's a mental practice. And this is where it links back to the yoga thing. You know, sitting in a stretch, even for 30 seconds, and especially if you've been living your life in a very sympathetic, nervous system state, so you do a lot of mouth breathing, and you're very, very stressed. Just sitting there calmly for 30 seconds to a minute is a very difficult thing to do. And this is why I say to people, look, if you can't do 30 seconds, do 3 sets of 10 seconds. Mm. It's probably not going to have any great effect, but it's building the habit and it's developing the mental discipline to stick with it.
Yeah.
Because you'll get people who say, do you know what? I've stretched in the past. I can never do the splits. And you're like, well, how long did you stretch for? And they're like, oh, I did like 3 sessions.
Yeah.
you you don't stop lifting weights after 3 sessions just because you didn't, you weren't like Arnold Schwarzenegger after a week.
Yeah.
You know, so why are you expecting to be like an elite level gymnast after a week? It's ridiculous. And it's a shame, because when flexibility training is done properly, it out of all the motor abilities, it develops the fastest.
Right.
And that's what a lot of people don't realize. When they develop flexibility slowly, it's because their method is lacking. They need to look at what they're doing and tweak what they're doing, because, a lot of coaching programs out there are very much cut, copy and paste, or what we call cookie cutter programs, mm-hmm. One size fits all. So it'll be do 3 sets of 30 seconds, but this person might have incredibly high levels of tissue stiffness that they need to hold the sustained stretch continuously for 2 minutes. For it to have an effect on that tissue stiffness. So if it's not working, change it, right? It's simple trial and error. And, a lot of people send me messages saying, what stretching should I do? And good flexibility coaching really is just a process of starting them somewhere and then seeing how the body responds to what you've asked them to do. Mm-hmm. And that's really all physical training.
Yeah.
Whether we're strength training, if I take on a client and they want to lift weights and I send them into the gym and they do, 20 rep squats with a 1 rep max, they're going to be dead for 2 weeks. I'm going to take that response and maybe dial it down next time. Depends how much they annoy me, I might dial it up. But you give them something to do based upon your best guess of their current capacities, because the body doesn't come with an instruction manual. So you have to guess what their current capacities are. And you probably dial it down a little bit just to be safe. You ask them to do the thing, they do the thing, they come back and say, how was it? And they say, well, I saw the next day here, this felt okay, I didn't like this. And you tweak it as you go along. I always say that as coaches, we are professional guessers. Don't have the answers, but we guess as we go along. And a lot of coaches don't like that. They think they have to know all the answers. You don't have all the answers. Nobody has all the answers.
No.
It's funny, if you read when you read the research, it's very humbling. Because you read a study and you think, oh, yes, this confirms my biases. And then you go to the limitations of the study and it's as long as the article itself. Yeah. always says more research is needed, because we don't have all the answers. Now, if the scientists and the researchers who are examining things in these super controlled conditions are essentially saying, we think this is what may be happening, but we don't know. We need more research. Then how the hell is a coach going to have all the answers, right?
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. So don't be ashamed of guessing your way through things. It keeps you more honest.
Yeah.
you know, and stops the ego getting in the way and making you think that you have all the answers, because nobody has all the answers.
No.
You know, even I don't have all the answers. Like, the stuff I post on my Instagram is my interpretation of the literature. You know, and there's been times when, you know, I've posted something and somebody's come back and said, well, what about this study? And it's a study I haven't read. And I've read it and I go, okay, that challenges my perception. I'll change the way I think about this. And the same is with coaching as well. You might have a preferred way of doing something, but then you go and take a course, or you work with someone, or you encounter a client for whom your preferred way of doing something doesn't work. So you then you change it intuitively. Mm. And you know, you have to maintain that flexibility, you know.
Yeah.
You know, pun intended.
Yeah, I think you also that bit you spoke about the mental side of training. And I honestly challenge any athlete who thinks they are disciplined in what they do to be disciplined in their flexibility training. I think it's the one Achilles heel of a lot of athletes that will believe, I can get up at I'm part 4:30 a.m. club, and I'll get up and I'll run the hills and I'll do that, and I'm disciplined. I'm like, right, well, how much time did you sit and actually stretch your body and look after it? I think there was a podcast I listened to of David Goggins, and he kind of brushed over it real quickly in this podcast, but people look at this guy and think he is just another level of insanity sometimes, but people will look at on their scale. But one thing he said that he constantly does is stretch, and he does it not only just for his body but for his mind to make sure his body can continue doing what he's doing, but also it is a skill, it is a resilience training that you're doing. And I would challenge people to say, like, is the reason you're not stretching because of your body, or is it because of your mind is stopping you early on? Mm. It's so true.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a mind body practice, isn't it? Because your mental state will influence what you physically do, and what you physically do will influence your mental state. So it's this constant feedback process. And I typically find it's athletes in power sports or very dynamic sports which struggle with the discipline of stretching. You know, like you touched on earlier, martial artists, dancers, and gymnasts are conditioned from very early on to stretch. They know it's necessary. So it's become a habit. So for athletes who have maybe expended some of their genetic inheritance to get to where they are, but now they're starting to struggle and they need to develop their flexibility, they haven't developed the habit, and they don't like developing the habit because they don't excel at something. And what I find is the more elite an athlete is, the harder they struggle with doing a new skill, because it's something they don't excel at, and they have this alpha, you know, dominant mentality where they want to be the best. And we don't like doing things we're not good at. And that applies to athletes as well as everyday folk. You know, somebody who's never stretched, they do a stretch, they want to touch the, you know, palms on the floor, which takes a long time. They can't get the fingertips past the knees. Like, oh, this sucks, I'm not going to do this anymore. You know, they go and do something else.
Yeah.
You know, something which doesn't work, but that problem is still there.
Yeah.
It's not dealt with. So
I was in that boat, like, definitely couldn't touch my knees. I remember being literally probably about third year as a pro, I remember being in like a hot bath and trying to reach my toes in the bath. I couldn't get there, literally couldn't get there. Now I can get palms on the floor, like, pretty much from getting up in the morning. And that has taken me 5 to 6 years, maybe. I think that's, but is it worth it? Hell yeah. Because my injury rate has gone down. My hamstring tears went down dramatically. And I saw a massive difference. I want to flick over it about breathing, and you kind of touched on it. When people get into a stretch, how important is breathing to that, and what type of breathing do you always recommend?
So, it's very important. So, I mean, I'm not a breathing expert, so this is really, you know, not a scientific treatise on on breathing. But generally with static passive stretching, you know, we want to get into this parasympathetic state to calm down our stretch reflex. So, you know, deep nasal breathing, you know, in for 4 seconds, hold it for a second, out through the mouth for 4 seconds is a great way to go. For static active stretching, when we're doing isometrics, we tend to want to keep the breathing pattern regular, but not too deep. Because when people tend to take deep breaths with the isometric contractions, the tension tends to waver. It tends to switch on and off.
Right.
So just shallow but steady breathing while the isometric contraction is being held is ideal. Certainly don't hold your breath while you do the isometric contraction, because especially if you have high blood pressure, because that blood pressure is just going to go up, right? Yes, some people, they tend to hold the breath because it allows them to contract the muscles with more intensity. But I've seen people faint after they release the contraction.
Wow.
You know, it's, yeah, isometrics can get very, very intense. So yeah, just deep, you know, just deep relaxed nasal breathing for static passive stretches, and just shallow regular breathing for isometrics.
Yeah.
Because what you're trying to do is keep steady, unwavering tension on the muscles. And, you know, taking in a deep breath, we tend to alter the level of tension, you know, the deeper and longer the breath. So keep it shallow, but keep it regular.
Yeah.
I don't mean hyperventilate, but just essentially breathe normally.
Yeah.
You can do things like when you release the isometric contraction and then increase the stretch, you could do that on an exhale, and that will help to facilitate a greater range of motion. And inhale at the start of the contraction can help as well. Same with static passive stretching. You know, you're doing the deep inhale and exhale, but when you go to increase the stretch, take a breath in and then exhale as you increase the stretch.
Mm-hmm.
And try and visualize as well this release of tension, because that as well helps the nervous system to relax and just relinquish some control on the muscles.
Yeah.
It's you could even do things like having your fist held in front of your hand, and as you contract the muscles, you tense up your hand and then the rest of your body, and then you relax and release everything with an exhalation, almost like an audible sigh, and then you'll just feel everything just ease off.
Yeah.
And you can get a greater stretch.
I mean, even if you just do it now, like, you feel that release in your body as you let go of a clenched fist. That's a really good tip. That's a great tip. Never really thought that.
Yeah, and the more you can do that, the more effective your stretches will be. Mm. And the more effective you can make a stretch in each session, the less sessions you're going to have to do overall to get to where you want to be. And so your training becomes more efficient.
Yeah.
And those are kind of the two gold standards of good training, in my opinion. It's effective, so it works, and it's efficient, so you have to do the least amount of time and effort.
Yeah.
You know, nobody wants to be spending like 20 years trying to do the splits. You know? Most people could do the splits within 12 months if their training is really dialed in.
Yeah,
I'm talking
right.
about people who can't even touch their knees, you know, can only open their legs a little bit. You know, you could get a full split in 12 months if that was the one thing you focused on and your training was dialed in.
That's a good point. How much of, so for an athlete, for people who are playing sport, and let's say, even if I take just my sport, for example, you might be playing sport on a Saturday, you're also going to be doing perhaps gym work alongside it. Mm-hmm. What's the reality of that progression? What is the reality of that progression if you're trying to gain flexibility whilst doing a sport? Would you need to fully commit to just flexibility training for, say, like you said, that year, and almost move all other training aside? Or is it going to lengthen that progression out?
No, you can integrate flexibility training into your current training program without diverting away from it too much. So typically, if I was taking on a new client, I'd look at what they're already doing and try and base their flexibility exercises around that. So if they are, let's say they do squat, they already do squat training, and they want to improve hip flexibility, the goal of the squat training will then become about increasing range of motion rather than overall strength.
Mm-hmm.
So we tweak what they're already doing. But, you know, the amount of work you need to do to improve flexibility typically doesn't interfere with what you're already doing. You do your dynamic stretches at the start of the workout during the warm-up, and you do your static passive stretches at the end of the workout after you've done everything else. If you're doing isometrics or eccentrics, you would do them in your strength-based workouts.
Yeah.
And if you're training with any regularity to make progress, then, you know, especially a sports person, they're probably training 6 days a week. If you're doing static passive stretching for a couple of minutes at the end of each workout, you're going to make rapid progress.
Right. You know,
most people only do it three times a week, so it's going to take longer. And if you're doing isometric stretches for the muscles that were worked in the strength training session, you're going to improve strength and flexibility that way as well. And as your static flexibility in your isometrics and relaxed stretches improves, your dynamic flexibility is going to be pulled up along with it. And so what you'll find is, as you're doing your dynamic stretching warm-up over a period of weeks to months, say you're a martial artist and you're trying to kick high, you're going to find these dynamic stretches are going to get higher and higher over the weeks, and takes less effort to raise your leg, basically, or get into whatever position you need to do. So those are ideally the best places to put the three main types of stretching you're going to do: dynamic stretches in the warm-up, static, isometric stretches after your strength, your main strength workout, and then after everything, static passive stretches. It doesn't have to get more complicated than that. And there's really not a great deal of load in those stretches that they're going to interfere with your development in other areas. However, if you're doing loaded isometrics, so you're, say somebody's training to do a split and they're trying to do a Van Damme chair split while pressing a barbell overhead, that's going to interfere with your ability to progress in other strength exercises because you're really taxing your resources within your body. So, but you can integrate flexibility training with your current training. But if, limitations and flexibility are a barrier to your progression in your current training, the focus has to move over to flexibility, especially if you're constantly getting injured, then you need to just take your attention off sports performance for a while and just look at basic physical function, of which flexibility is absolutely necessary.
What has the literature shown, or what are there any highlighted pieces in the literature that you've seen around sports performance and injury rates? I guess those are two different things there, really, but I guess injury rates is probably the most. We've been speaking a lot about how flexibility is a sort of key to strength and underpinning the rest of the components. So I guess let's turn our attention to the injury rates, because for me, that was where I started. I wanted to reduce the injury rates that I got. What is some of the piece of literature that got to say about injury rates?
Yeah, it's a very murky subject, because most of the literature looks at stretching an injury. Now, stretching isn't flexibility. Stretching is flexibility development or flexibility training. Mm-hmm. So, and the typical injury and stretching study looks at pre-exercise stretching and whether people got injured or not. Stretching before a workout isn't going to offer much of a safeguard against injury. What the literature does show is a general trend towards having sufficient flexibility offering a bit of a buffer against against injury. And the reason for that is flexibility allows us to get into whatever position we want to get into and exert force in that position in order to resist external forces acting on the body. And it improves our ability, or the ability of our tissues, to absorb energy. Funnily enough, energy is often called the agent of injury. And when we have an injury, it's because the tissues don't have the capacity to absorb and dissipate that energy. And there's different types of energy: thermal, chemical, electrical, etc. And they can all cause injury. Thermal injury can cause a burn, but sports injuries are caused by mechanical energy. And so there's a fundamental relationship between mechanical energy, or the energy which is dumped on the body by forces, so a push or a pull, whether that's ground reaction force or somebody slamming into you, or the pull of your muscles. And so there's a fundamental relationship between mechanical energy and injury. And one of the most effective ways that we can mitigate or lower the risk of injury, because there's no such thing as injury prevention. We can't prevent an injury. If you are physically active in any capacity, you're exposed to forces on a daily basis, an injury is going to happen at some point. It's just a fact of life. But we can manage that risk by improving our ability to get into positions, so have flexibility, and exert force. Our ability to exert force is our strength. So we need to be combining, for injury prevention or injury, not injury prevention, injury management, we need to be improving our ability to get into positions and also exert force or get stronger in those positions. And this is why things like isometric training and eccentric training have such a high success, such a successful rate at reducing injuries, because it's the ability to exert force and and essentially push back those external forces which would otherwise be absorbed and cause injury. And when we do that, we, you know, when we improve strength in those positions or strength at length, as a good friend of mine, Lucas Aaron, called it, he's on Instagram, Range of Strength.
Yeah.
So he combines that modality, you know, lengthening and strengthening extremely well. You know, we're manipulating the characteristics of muscular actions in order to improve tissue tolerance. So that's structural strength, or how well the tissues can take, you know, absorb forces. We're improving our volitional strength, so our ability to exert a force to overcome an external resistance. And those two things are absolutely key to, you know, pushing back the chances of getting an injury. Because when you look at most flexibility training in like the Premier League, for example, you know, we call it football. If you have listeners in North America, it's soccer. You know, just committed blasphemy. You'll find they'll do a few static stretches at the start and some dynamic stretches. And they're like, oh, but we do flexibility training. You're like, well, okay, what strength training do you do? And they're like, oh, we do back squats and overhead press. It's like, okay, are you doing them in a lengthened position? You know, where you, like a goalkeeper, for example, needs to really outstretch the legs to stop a low shot. No, well, that's probably why you're getting injured in that position. You know, we think about hamstring strains. How is a hamstring strain happening? Well, the hamstring is lengthening at speed as the footballer is trying to reach out to do a tackle or get the ball or shoot, etc. So what do? We lengthen that muscle and then we apply muscular contractions to build force, isometric stretching, you know?
Yeah.
Think of it as flexibility strength training, you know, flexibility hyphen strength. That's what essentially is crucial to injury mitigation.
I think it was Jeff or at Flexible and or Lucas, like you said, at Range of Strength. Like, they're both two, again, great accounts to follow. One of them put up something around a baseball player that was sliding in for like first base or something like that, and he overshot it but managed to keep his foot on and went into a full split. And you think, well, how did nothing snap? How did nothing go? And a lot of people would have winced at that. But going back to what you said at the start about having that passive static range and having that real range to develop that dynamic and active range, that's what he had. Like, clearly showed it. He was just showing it in a very practical environment that, for him, if you're an athlete, it actually gained him an advantage. And I think everyone, think of anyone that might be flexible in a sport. Djokovic is a good example of that. Like, his ability to reach cross court, go into that side split position, that's a trained position. Whether he's been doing that for, I don't know his background, and I can't speak for his training, but you can tell that is a trained position that he's gone to. You don't get into that many times without being a consequence or coincidence. Sorry.
Yeah.
So it just shows like that range is going to be an advantage at some stage, whether it's through performance there that can give you that little bit of an edge, or injury mitigate or buffering. Yeah, it's a good word to use for that, buffering.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Always have a look, you know, the people say, well, what's the ideal amount of flexibility? It's what you need plus a little bit more. And we're talking 10 to 20 degrees if we want to be academic, you know?
Right.
If you need to stretch to 110 degrees, develop a split to 130 as a practical example, you know? So just whatever you need plus a bit of a buffer.
That's finding your limits. That's finding where you're learning about your body at the same time. I think that's a big part of flexibility training. You're learning so much about your body. It gives you such a self-awareness around your body. You get, and again, self-awareness physically, mentally, whichever way you want to look at it, that, as an athlete, is a huge advantage in sport to know thy body, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is the recovery part of flexibility. Now, we talked about DOMS and things like that. You got to recover from this stuff. So what sort of recovery are you recommending, whether it be through... I wrote about hydration, but I think nutrition obviously plays a big part. Is there research showing in hydration levels and your ability to be flexible and build your flexibility, or nutrition that's
No, there's a lot of claims about, you know, eat this, you know, this food or drink this amount of water to maintain your flexibility. There are no good quality studies that examine the link between nutrition and or hydration and flexibility. Now, we could probably make, you know, a bit of a leap by saying, you know, if you are eating foods which cause systemic inflammation, that's probably going to make your tissues a bit more restricted. Or if you're, you know, a bit of a heightened pain response, you're probably going to find, you know, stretches a bit more unbearable. If you are dehydrated, then your tissues may lack extensibility, especially in the connective tissue, because it has a high fluid content. But there's nothing that we can say definitively that you have to, you know, eat these foods or these nutritional supplements or drink this amount of water. It's just really maintaining healthy habits to keep your overall body in good balance. More for mental health than anything else, because we've been talking about physical flexibility. There's also cognitive and affective flexibility, and they are interlinked. So cognitive flexibility is your ability to think clearly, think outside the box, or, you know, think laterally, and make good judgments. And affective flexibility is your emotional regulation. And it's interesting, there's a part of the brain called the limbic system or the limbic network. Its name mm-hmm. changes, but it's a tiny little part in the brain, and it's responsible for motor coordination, which affects flexibility, but also your emotional regulation. And if you're in if your mental health is such that you're in a heightened state of anxiety, that is going to put you in a heightened sympathetic state that therefore is going to dial up your muscle tone. Right. Your muscles become more restricted. Therefore, flexibility training becomes harder. What we tend to find is the people who are usually most flexible through training, not through natural circumstances like, you know, joint architecture and things like that, but people who have trained to become flexible tend to have good levels of cognitive and emotional flexibility as well. So they are right. interlinked. So, and this, and again, this goes back to, like we're talking about with yoga.
Yeah.
It's not just a physical flexibility practice. It is a cognitive and emotional flexibility practice too, because what you find is when you hold these positions, your mental state becomes more balanced.
Yeah.
You know, and it all just feeds back into each other. It's like this constant feedback loop where, you know, everything benefits everything else. So if you're looking after yourself with good nutrition and adequate hydration, then your mental state is going to be much more optimal. You're more likely to maintain good physical habits like stretching. You won't be as sensitive to the stretch, so you can push a bit further, you can progress faster, and it all just repeats itself like that. But in terms of science, there's nothing to say you have to drink 2 liters of water a day to maintain flexibility. You know, not at all.
That's fascinating. That's almost that blend of like science versus feeling is so true. I've been into a yoga class, and I've been into a yin yoga class where grown men have been crying through hip releases because of the awareness. And I speak about this to athletes I've worked with, where it's the awareness you get from stretching and recognizing where your mind was at during that whole moment. And once you get that release, once you've gone through that physical pain and you feel that release, you suddenly realize like how stressed you were. You feel where your emotional release has come from. And that is so vital for everything being able, and what a beautiful way to describe it about almost performance and well-being being where the body almost meets the mind, and the mind having that impact on the body. And that's something that I think when we look at some of the people that you're calling out on social media that promote a lot of methods that are purely physical, it's really not taking into account the mental side of it and the emotional and the person that is behind that stretch, essentially. Most of it is just like, load yourself with this. And I always think of that when I look at some of these mobility trainings that are being promoted and different training styles that are being put out there. I'm like, there's nothing there that is promoting the person. There's nothing there that's allowing that person to think clearer. Where's that benefit apart from them being able to get a 90 degree angle here, there, or 180 there? but what's their emotional benefit? What's their life benefit from it? And that way you described that was such a beautiful way of actually interlinking them both.
Yeah, it's funny as well, because people look at my account and my tagline is, teaching the science of flexibility, and people just think about physical flexibility and they think the whole emotional and mental side of things is a bit wishy-washy, a bit spiritual. As well, actually, there's a lot of hard science to support this link between physical, mental and emotional, and it links up to what we know about the biopsychosocial model of pain, for example.
Yeah.
And we can extrapolate those findings to flexibility as well. So, people say, well, the techniques are the most important part of the flexibility training journey. And it's not actually, it's the environment, because your environment informs your psychology informs your behavior informs what physical actions you take. So I could take on a client who, wants to get flexible, and I give them the most advanced, effective training method in the world, and they take it away. But if they live in a house which is chaotic and they've got so many different family commitments that they simply don't have the time, or they have social pressure to not improve themselves, they won't get better. So the environment is the first thing I look at as a flexibility coach. What is your family? And this is why building rapport is so important, getting to know the person. Like whenever I do the initial consultation with someone, it's getting to know them as a person. What's your family life like? How did your parents raise you as a kid? Because your attachment style has a major part to play in how you approach things. So whether you are anxious or avoidant or secure is going to affect how I approach your training. What do you do for a job? If you are a manual laborer who works 15 hours a day because you're trying to provide for a family because maybe your partner was injured and they can't work, then I'm not going to be having you training 8 hours a week, right? I'm going to find ways to integrate this training with what you do.
Yeah.
And make it as easy as possible for you. And this is why I said coaches are professional guessers, because until that person is in front of you and is telling you their story, it's guesswork, and you're guessing along the way as well. This is why, there are, one size fits all coaching programs, which people will find effective, and, like remote online coaching where people sign up to a group program can be effective if you have a coach who can tell you how to tailor that for your circumstances. But it takes a lot of autonomy on part of the client to do that, or the student to do that. But, some of the approaches to any kind of physical training are very, very myopic, very short-sighted. They just focus on the physical. Like, your joint needs to display X degrees of range of motion. It's like, well, what does this person want to do with their body? That's the first thing I ask. Somebody says, I want to get flexible. Okay, what do you want to do?
Yeah.
I did a post a couple of days ago on how to develop a flexibility training program. And the first step it says is, think about what you want to do with your body. Yeah. Do you want to take up dance? And athletes have the advantage because they've learned from a very young age what they want to do with their bodies.
Yeah.
They have a very specific purpose. So, coaches have this tendency to think athletes are harder to train than general population because they're elite. They've got to meet these performance demands. There's a lot of pressure, but it's very easy to tailor a training program, a flexibility training program for an elite athlete compared to general population person who just wants to improve their health and they don't have an idea of what they want to do. They've just, they've maybe had some news from the doctor, or they're finding it difficult to play with the grandkids and they just want to improve that ability. Well, okay, what things do you want to do? What do you enjoy? What goals have you had that maybe you haven't realized yet? And it takes, a lot of, several conversations to reach that point before you actually design a training program. And that's something people have to account for. But this whole attitude about, science-based flexibility training is purely flexible is nonsense. And if it's not accounting for person's psychology and their affective state or the psychobiology, which is the biology of behavior and why people think the way they do, then it's not science-based. It's really not. And you're missing a huge chunk off the table. You're missing a huge piece of the puzzle.
Wow, that mate, that's such a breath of fresh air to hear that from a coach. And I think people listening that even follow your work I think we'll take that on board and straight away put that into practice. You've been so generous with your time. Like, this has been an amazing conversation. I just want to talk about your course your course that you host. How often do you host it?
Yeah, it's usually about 6 times a year. So every kind of 2 to 3 months, there's a new intake opening. There's one open at the moment, which starts on the 20th of June. I was about to say 20th of January. Then.
Yeah.
the next one will probably be towards the end of August, start of September. And the reason I do that is, like I say, I limit the number of people that come onto the course, just so I can give them the individual attention they need, because it's hosted in a private forum where you can ask unlimited questions. It's not a case of you pay to get in and then you're left to your own devices. Mm. My goal is to get you through the course and to make you a good coach. Mm-hmm. And it's 16 weeks long, but you can take as long as you want to finish it. There's no deadlines. There are group support calls over Zoom twice weekly. There's a chat room. There's an instant messenger function. It's very easy to get in contact and ask questions, because what people typically find is they, you know, after 2 or 3 weeks into it, they've got more questions than they started with. And they're like, holy hell, I didn't realize what this, you know, what this stuff actually entails, because flexibility is, you know, there's so many layers to it. There's so many things to consider. And I make it as simple as possible, as simple as I can. But even when I try to simplify it, people aren't going to understand things. And that's not anything to do with how intelligent they are. It's just, you know, through the lenses they're able to look at things through, they may not understand a particular concept. So, you know, I have to try and reword things as many times as it takes until they actually understand what I'm saying. Hmm. You know, because I'm only human at the end of the day. And I've tried to, you know, cover as many different learning styles and levels of education as possible, you know, because it's like you'll get people coming in who have no experience. So you have to simplify it as much as possible. Then you'll have, you know, I've had doctors of physical therapy have signed up for the course. And I'm always thinking, well, am I insulting their intelligence? And well, no, it's not, because when I did, so my degrees were in kinesiology, I was actually on the path to become a doctor of physical therapy. But it really wasn't what I thought it was going to be. It was so overinflated. So I switched to kinesiology and biomechanics instead. And everything on the course is looked at through the lens of biomechanics, you know, how our body interacts with the forces acting upon it, because that's ultimately what affects how our body responds, you know? So it's unique in the sense that it takes a biomechanics approach to flexibility training.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I've been doing a lot of posts on biomechanics lately, because there's people out there saying, oh, we do biomechanics and we do it best. And I'll say, well, which part? And they're like, what do you mean, which part? I'm like, well, biomechanics isn't what an exercise looks like. That is a very, very small part of biomechanical analysis. You know, we have different branches of biomechanics, and each of those branches has subdivisions. My favorite parts are tissue and cellular biomechanics, because that's where all the magical stuff happens.
Yeah.
And that's important for flexibility training, especially when you have people saying stretching is only neural, which it's not. When you understand what happens at the cellular and tissue levels, it's absolute nonsense. But yeah, I mean, the course is open to anyone and everyone. You know, if you have any questions, just get in touch. I am hosting a free event next week on the 7th, 8th. I don't know when this will go out, but on the 7th, 8th and 9th of June, there's a free event. Just have to register via the link in my Instagram bio, and you get an invite to the Facebook pop-up group where the events will be live streamed. But if you can't make the times, they will be recorded for you to watch back. But yeah, if you're interested in that course, just go to flexibilityresearch.com and all the stuff's on there. If you've got questions, send me an email. Don't DM me on Instagram. my inbox is absolutely chaos at the moment. You know, it's hard to keep up with all the DMs coming in. Most of them are just reactions to stories. But, you know, I try and respond to every single one. But send me a message, an email. You're more likely to get a better response.
But I think if anything, and keep doing what you're doing, like what you're doing, the most important part, I think, out of what I see from your stuff is the simplification of it. And I would just say, don't doubt that, because if it passed the 5-year-old test in the fact you can explain it to a 5-year-old, it's a good piece of work. And that's a skill. Like, that's a skill to take that hugely scientific, literature-based knowledge and then give it to people that can actually, and you mentioned it earlier, communicate that to a student, communicate that to their athlete, communicate to anyone. That's so important. People don't, the everyday person who is interested in trying to get more flexible, they don't understand the, nor do they probably want to go into the literature. So yeah, keep making it simple, mate. Like, it's so valuable, and everyone can digest it from there. Yeah. I'll leave links in the show notes for all of your website, your Instagram at flexibility.research, so people can find you, like I said, email you, don't DM, because it's going to take a while.
Champion.
But mate, thank you so much for this conversation. It's been fascinating. Some of this stuff that you've gone into, the mind, body, the everything from the technical to the spiritual almost. It's been fascinating, and I'm sure people are going to get loads out of this, especially people that follow your work, for sure.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the opportunity. You know, I love sharing this stuff. So thanks for giving me a platform to speak. So I appreciate your time as well.
No stress. Cheers, mate.